Hello and welcome back to the Fall of the Roman Empire. It's Nick Holmes and this is episode 82 called The Kingdom of the Ostrogoths. In this episode, we're turning to Ostrogothic Italy, since this was now the focus of attention for Justinian and the moment when his dreams of restoring the Roman Empire really took hold. The first point is that it was an entirely new kingdom and one created by a single powerful and charismatic ruler called Theodoric the Great. He'd created it and ruled it for an extraordinary 33 years, ever since he'd personally slain Odoacer, the German warlord and self-proclaimed King of Italy, who'd been responsible for bringing the Western Roman Empire to an end when he deposed Romulus Augustulus in 476. Theodoric had killed Odoacer in Ravenna in 493 in direct contravention of a treaty the two had agreed for joint rule of Italy. The chronicler John of Antioch described how he tricked Odoacer into thinking he was safe until one day two of Theodoric's men approached him as supplicants and grasped him by the hands so that he couldn't move or resist. Theodoric advanced upon the hapless German with his sword, and with a single stroke he clove him in two from the collarbone to the hip. As Odoacer collapsed, Theodoric quipped, "I always thought he hadn't got a bone in his body." Clearly, Theodoric wasn't a man to mess around with. He had a reputation as a great warrior, based largely on stories of killing his enemies with his own hands, like this. For example, in 471, at the tender age of 18, he's said to have killed his first royal victim, a Sarmatian king, Babai, during a campaign he was leading. In 482, he killed a rival Gothic king, Resitach, after which, as described in episode 68, he led his army out of the Balkans and into Italy to depose Odoacer in 488. Much to the Eastern Emperor Leo's relief. Leo had worked hard to get rid of this troublesome warlord who'd led his horde of Ostrogoths, or simply Goths, as we will henceforth call them in this episode, since we don't need to distinguish them from the separate group of Goths in Spain historians call the Visigoths, to the walls of Constantinople only the year before. Indeed, securing the Goths' migration to Italy must be regarded as Leo's greatest achievement. Now, the key point is that our few surviving sources mainly regard Theodoric's reign as a success. According to them, under his rule, Italy enjoyed one of its longest periods of peace and prosperity in over a century. For example, one of our best insights into life in his reign comes from the writings of the biographer of Fulgentius, a Roman African priest who was made a saint and travelled to Rome in the year 500 at exactly the moment that Theodoric made his first visit to the Eternal City. Theodoric only went to Rome once, since, like Odoacer and most of the previous Roman emperors, he ruled from Ravenna, not Rome. But in the year 500, he visited Rome for the first time to celebrate his 30 years of rule, his tricennalia, in the tradition of the Roman emperors going back to Diocletian. You may wonder how he was celebrating his tricennalia when he'd only been ruling in Italy for 7 years since 493, when he killed Odoacer, but his propaganda machine engineered the story that he'd been a king ever since he killed his first victim, as I mentioned, the Sarmatian king, 30 years before. Fulgentius's biographer gives us a fascinating insight into what Rome was like at this time. Its population had been in steady decline ever since Alaric's sack of the city in 410, and by 500 it had fallen to a fraction of its former size, from around 500,000 in 400 to only some 50,000 to 100,000. But that was still a large number for its time and made it the largest city in the Western Mediterranean. The chronicler Cassiodorus, who lived in the city, compared it to someone whose clothes have become too big for them. He marvelled at the size of the public buildings and walls. Quote, "The vast expanses of the walls, the wide embrace for spectacles, the astonishing size of the baths, and that multitude of mills, which served specifically to provide food, attest to the throngs of its citizens in the past." End quote. He described its inhabitants living in the shadows of the colossal monuments. Large areas of the city within its walls were derelict and abandoned, with rubbish tips growing and land being used for small-scale cultivation. But it was still the residence of the senatorial classes, who maintained large houses and whose revenues from their estates around Italy still poured into Rome, bringing some wealth to its population. There was also, of course, the church. The Bishop of Rome, or the Pope, as he was now called, was the most powerful and wealthiest of the clerics in the West, and Rome had the largest Christian churches in the West. Churches such as the old St. Peter's, replaced, of course, by the modern St. Peter's in the 16th century, and its sister church of St. Paul Beyond the Walls, as it's called, which still stands in a restored Roman construction. Into this strange world came Theodoric. The inhabitants of Rome treated him in the same way they would have done Valentinian III or any previous Roman emperor, although those emperors of old would, no doubt, have been truly horrified to see the Roman population bowing to a barbarian king. Now, in March 500, the entire Roman population flocked to meet its Gothic ruler. This time, however, just to emphasise how much life had changed, not only were they paying homage to a barbarian, but they were led by the Pope and not by the Senate. Pope Symmachus led the city's inhabitants to meet the Gothic king, with the senators following close behind, and behind them the mass of ordinary people. Theodoric's first stop was St. Peter's Basilica, where he paid his respects at the saint's grave. This was despite the fact Theodoric was an Arian, regarded as a heretic by the Catholic Church. And in return, the Arian Church didn't officially recognise Symmachus as Bishop of Rome, something I will return to shortly. Theodoric then crossed the River Tiber on the Pons Aelius, built by Hadrian centuries before, which still stands today as the Ponte Sant'Angelo Bridge, one of Rome's most popular tourist attractions, now adorned with statues of angels, and until they were banned, thousands of love padlocks. From there, the Gothic king passed along a route to the Forum, through the triumphal arches of Constantine and Titus beside the Colosseum, until finally he reached the Senate House, the Curia, which still stands today amidst the chaotic collection of surviving bits and pieces of ancient buildings that makes up the Forum in modern Rome. The Curia, however, is remarkably well preserved and has just recently been restored in modern Rome, so that tourists can visit it in pretty much the same condition that Theodoric saw it. There, the Gothic king addressed the senators in Latin and promised to venerate them as Romans. Because of occasions like this, when Theodoric paid homage to the city of Rome and its glorious past, most historians tend to regard him as an enlightened ruler who encouraged a multicultural and tolerant society. But I don't think this is accurate. Instead, I suggest, like so many other rulers, and indeed Justinian himself, Theodoric's top priority was simply to maintain his own authority and power. He had no longer-term vision for his state. He was a pragmatist and not a visionary. This view is echoed in a recently published book by a German historian, Hans Ulrich Wiemer, in which he describes Theodoric's rule not as enlightened, but as a cynical attempt to keep both peoples, that is Romans and Goths, under his control through a policy he describes as, quote, integration through separation. For example, the Goths remained an entirely military society, while the Roman population was completely excluded from any military service whatsoever. Indeed, they were forbidden to be soldiers. Romans weren't even allowed to carry weapons other than those for hunting, like daggers. This meant the Goths, with Theodoric as their king, were the masters of Italy with the military muscle to impose their will without any resistance. At the same time, to buy the loyalty of the Goths, Theodoric rewarded them, maybe 100,000 of them, including around 25,000 warriors, with land taken from the Roman senatorial class. So why did the Roman senators agree to give up their land and support Theodoric's imposition of Gothic rule? The answer was that they had little choice. The fall of the Western Empire was primarily due to military failure, as we've discussed in previous episodes. The professional Western Roman army was largely destroyed in Theodosius I's civil wars. What remained of it was further reduced during Stilicho's wars and the great barbarian invasion across the Rhine of 406. By the time Alaric sacked Rome in 410, the Western Roman army was a small and ineffective force. The Western Romans had completely lost their military prowess. But the Western Roman senators were still in control of most of the land, despite a significant part being given to Theodoric's Gothic followers, as I mentioned. This meant they were still wealthy and were valuable to Theodoric as an efficient source of tax collection. For example, during the period from 410 to 476, when the Western Empire ceased to exist as a Roman entity, most but not all of the Senate seems to have supported German military leaders in exchange for their protection. Only a minority of senators appears to have aimed for a restoration of the imperial regime. A good example of this occurred in 461 when the Western Emperor Majorian was murdered by the German warlord Ricimer, who became the de facto king of Italy. Astonishingly, most of the Senate actually supported Ricimer against Majorian, because they preferred having a friendly German ruler to paying higher taxes to fund an attempt to restore Roman authority. Another astonishing aspect of the Gothic Roman regime in Italy, similar to that of the Vandals in North Africa, was the duality in its religion. Theodoric and his Goths were Arians, not Catholics, as I've mentioned. And as we've discussed in previous episodes, this argument about the true nature of Christ had divided Christianity in the 4th century. Arians believed that Christ was subordinate to God, while Catholics believed he was one with God. First pronounced by Arius in Egypt in the late 3rd century, the Arian faith had many supporters, and despite Constantine declaring it a heresy at the Council of Nicaea in 325, it remained popular and was even endorsed by the emperors Constantius II and Valens. But it then declined, especially in the West, where an aggressive Catholic church persecuted it. However, because of the missionary work of Arian preachers, many of the barbarian invaders of the 5th century, if they weren't pagans, such as the Franks and Alemanni were Arian, including, of course, principally the Goths and Vandals. Their conquest of most of the Western Empire made Arianism into a legitimate force yet again. This meant that in Italy, while almost all the estimated 6 million Italian inhabitants were Catholic, the largely Germanic mercenary army that replaced the Italian legions was Arian. A truly bizarre situation then developed, with the de facto rulers of Italy belonging to a faith regarded as heretical by the vast majority of Italy's inhabitants. But this didn't matter too much in the everyday life of the 6 million or so Roman population, since most of the approximately 100,000 Goths lived in northern Italy, in a region of the Po Valley stretching from Milan in the west to Verona and Ravenna in the east. There were also small Gothic garrisons in the main towns and cities throughout the length and breadth of Italy, but again, most were in the north, since that was where the greatest military threat existed in the form of the Franks and Burgundians. So, in most places in Italy, and especially in the south, it was actually rare to see a Goth. Where it did matter was in Ravenna, which was the home of the Gothic court and the heart of the Gothic administration. Although in the rest of Italy, almost all the churches and clergy were Catholic, in Ravenna, in particular, Theodoric built several magnificent Arian churches. One of these that survived almost intact, the Basilica of Sant'Apollinare Nuovo in the centre of modern Ravenna, contains stunning mosaics made by Roman craftsmen, but clearly in celebration of the Gothic court and king. It was situated next to Theodoric's palace, which was another imposing construction. According to the Roman chronicler Cassiodorus, quote, "The marble surface shines with the same colour as gems. The scattered gold gleams. The gifts of mosaic work delineate the circling rows of stones, and the whole is adorned with marble hues where the waxen pictures are displayed," end quote. But perhaps the most striking of Theodoric's buildings was his own mausoleum, again perfectly preserved in modern Ravenna. I mentioned in episode 68, this is made of beautifully carved white Istrian stone and has a dome fashioned from a single piece of stone, 10 metres in diameter and weighing a colossal 230 tons. Quite how it was raised and put in place still remains a mystery, but it must have involved a huge amount of time and effort and serves as testimony to the wealth of the Ostrogothic kingdom. So we can see this Gothic regime was full of contradictions, and towards the end of Theodoric's reign, the cracks began to show. The direct cause of this was growing pressure on the Goths from Constantinople. This began when the Eastern Emperor Anastasius died in 518. Until then, Constantinople had tolerated the Gothic kingdom in Italy, partly out of sheer relief that the Goths had left the Balkans and were no longer threatening Constantinople itself, but also because there'd been a rift between Rome and Constantinople over religion. The Eastern Emperor Anastasius had been pro-monophysite, which couldn't be accepted by the Pope and the Catholic Church, so there was little chance of a united Western and Eastern Roman front against Theodoric. This had been a tremendous help to Theodoric's authority in Italy. However, when Justin ascended the throne in 518, he was a Chalcedonian who looked to heal the rift between Rome and Constantinople, and this presented a direct threat to Theodoric. It meant both the Roman Senate and the Catholic Church began to view Constantinople as an ally, and that was when Theodoric's relations with both Senate and Pope started to break down. First, a major ruction with the Senate occurred in 523 when the highly respected senator and philosopher Boethius was accused of treason, condemned to death, and after a long imprisonment, executed in October 524. The cause of his alleged treason was his support for a senator named Albinus, who was accused of illicitly corresponding with the Eastern Emperor Justin. When Boethius's correspondence was examined, it was found that he hoped, quote, "Roman liberty would be restored," a clearly treacherous thing to say. Albinus was also executed, and later on so was Symmachus, another highly distinguished senator. Theodoric's decision to execute these men in the 520s shows a fundamental change in the Gothic-Roman relationship. Incidentally, it's worth mentioning that during his imprisonment, Boethius wrote The Consolation of Philosophy, inspired by Plato, which argues that despite all the suffering in life, there exists a higher power based on logic and reason. It's a well-known work today, and it became especially famous in the Middle Ages as one of the few available insights into Greek and Roman philosophy, since most of the works of Plato and Aristotle were lost in the West until they were brought by the fleeing inhabitants of Constantinople after its fall to the Turks in 1453. But back to Theodoric, who responded to the growing threat from Constantinople by adopting a more openly combative stance for the Arian faith. In 523, we know of an extraordinary incident from a source called the anonymous Valassianus, a chronicle written in the 6th century by an unknown author, who some historians suspect was the Bishop of Ravenna, Maximianus, that Theodoric ordered the Pope John I to go to Constantinople in either late 525 or early 526 to put the case to the Emperor Justin for Arians to be tolerated in the Eastern Roman Empire. Not only is it truly astonishing that John I agreed to undertake this mission at all, which must have meant he was put under considerable pressure by Theodoric, but he also doesn't seem to have met with any success, since when he returned to Italy in May 526, he apparently fell into disfavour with Theodoric and died soon afterwards, with another source claiming he was actually imprisoned and martyred. In the same year, a rumour circulated around Italy that Theodoric was planning to persecute Catholics and forcibly convert them to Arianism. If this is true, and unfortunately our sources are so limited we can't be completely sure of anything in this period, it was like putting petrol on a smouldering bonfire. Suddenly, the apparently friendly coexistence between Romans and Goths earlier in Theodoric's reign was going up in smoke. The truth was that, just as had been the case with the Vandals, Theodoric's kingdom was a deeply flawed attempt to keep a small governing elite in power. And now it would face its greatest test, for Belisarius was ready to march on Rome. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And in the next episode, which will be in a week's time, on the 30th of March, we'll continue with the extraordinary story of Justinian, Belisarius, and the Age of Reconquest. And in the meantime, if you like the podcast, please leave a review, and I'd be delighted if you wanted to recommend it to a friend. And of course, do also check out my website, nickholmesauthor.com, link in the show notes, to find maps, blogs, and a free ebook. And don't forget to take a look at my latest book, Rome and Attila, again, link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.